The fuck kind of neighborhood is this?
People are under a lot of stress, Bradley.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to Peaks TV. I'm David Chen.
I'm Joanna Robinson.
And what we do here on this podcast is we recap every couple episodes of Twin Peaks, The Return on Showtime. Find more episodes of this podcast at peakstv.com. Email us at peakstv@gmail.com. This week, we're going to be recapping parts 15 and 16 of Twin Peaks, The Return. Joanna Robinson, I think it's safe to say that this has been an absolutely riveting couple of episodes, right?
Yes.
Really
the best
strong
pair, I think, yeah.
Yeah, the best pair that we've done possibly mm-hmm. so far as we've been recapping the show.
Yeah.
Super strong, very exciting, and has really made me appreciate what David Lynch is doing, you know, this whole season. Let's dive right into it. I mean, we have a couple of emails, but we'll talk about them as they come up in the story. I'm going to read the plot summary here from Wikipedia. Cooper's doppelganger arrives at the convenience store to ask Jeffries, whose voice emanates from a metal container, about the assassination attempt and his reference to Judy. Jeffries tells him he has already met Judy and gives him numbers. Let's just pause right there, because that took up a lot of the first part of this episode, part 15.
Yeah.
This sequence was so amazing. Like, first of all, Cooper arriving at the convenience store. Like, we see that it's a place you can actually drive to.
Yeah.
That's nuts. Right? That's crazy.
Yeah, that is crazy.
He goes inside and kind of like fades out of existence into the location.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought the whole inside and the way it was done and him walking towards the thing was incredible.
Yeah.
It just super creepy, very atmospheric, great production design, what David Lynch does best. And go ahead, Jenna.
Well, I was going to say, now we know how they would handle the Jeffries issue, right? Because there's a question of, would we see a cameo from David Bowie? You know, I think we thought we had already had that question answered when they did the black and white flashback a couple episodes ago. But then this is like Jeffries in real time. This is how he's being conveyed. And it's certainly not a Bowie cameo, though that would have been like great and upsetting to see.
I think there's two amazing kind of mental leaps that I make with how Jeffries is portrayed on screen. First of all, I think only a mind like David Lynch could think, oh, hey, there's no Jeffries. Instead, let's represent him with a gigantic tea kettle that emanates smoke with images in it.
Uh-huh.
I would have never thought of that. And then not only that, let's make that image the creepiest image ever. As Dylan Schwann in the chat room says, Jeffries is the creepiest tea kettle, right? I completely agree. I mean, I have no idea how he made a tea kettle with smoke coming out of it seem ominous and threatening, but he did it. It was very, very scary. What'd you think?
Yeah, no, it was so creepy, that whole sequence. They've really done a good job with these really strange, like expanding on the strange iconography that we're familiar with in the original series. So like, you know, we know the zigzag floors and we know the red curtains, but they really sort of expanded the options in terms of what we see in these lodges in this return.
Yeah, so it was a great moment. And Jeffries talks about Judy and gives some numbers. And do you were you able to put together what's going on here exactly?
I mean, so Judy is a reference to Fire Walk With Me, right?
A character that Jeffries makes reference to in that movie, yeah.
In Fire Walk With Me, yeah. So I think a lot of people were expecting that Judy would somehow be important about it. I don't know what the numbers mean. Do you know what the numbers mean?
But then in the next episode, Cooper's doppelganger says like that he got three sets of numbers and two of them match, right? So that was one of the sets of numbers, right?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So he's getting this location that he needs to go to. Why don't we talk about it when we get to the next episode?
Mm-hmm.
But this is a set of numbers that is significant to Cooper. It's coordinates, basically, right?
Yeah.
And so we'll talk more about the significance.
But we've just seen like so many different coordinates this season.
Yes,
you know?
So many coordinates. I mean, you know, even think through episode 9 when they find the coordinates in that like Bobby, right, finds those coordinates in that metal cylinder, right? Anyway, outside, Richard, again, like Richard showing up at this place, that's crazy. Like you can drive to it. It's like there's GPS that goes to the place. Anyway, Richard attacks a doppelganger whom he recognized as an FBI agent his mother Audrey knew, but is subdued. So Richard finds a doppelganger and then like is subdued. I don't know if there's anything more to say about this scene. Obviously, the Richard stuff like takes on a more significance next episode. But thought I'd mention it. Anything you want to say about that scene?
Well, also we see the convenience store like fade out of existence, right?
Yeah.
And
this is the one that we also see in episode 8, I believe, right?
Yeah. Probably. And a friend of mine who loves the show and like watches it very closely, he texted me and he's like, "So it's a TARDIS?" And I don't know if you've ever watched Doctor Who or like are familiar with the way in which the TARDIS, which is the police box that the main character flies around in, it exits and enters the scene with like very, very, very similar visuals and sounds. And like, I'm really curious to know if people think this was an intentional homage to Doctor Who. I have no evidence that like David Lynch is into Doctor Who or what, but I thought it was really funny.
I have not seen any Doctor Who, so I can't comment, unfortunately. Before we move on, I did want to mention this email that we got to peakstv@gmail.com from Ben Pearson, who's been recapping Twin Peaks for slashfilm.com. When Dale Cooper walks into the convenience store, first asks a woodsman to see Jeffries, the guard flips a switch behind the TV, revealing some shaky, quick images of a masked figure that recalls the Jumping Man, a character who appeared at a meeting above a convenience store in Firewalk with Me. Ben Pearson went frame by frame through the footage of the character's face, and it looks like Lynch and Frost have superimposed Sarah Palmer's face over that mask. He takes a screenshot here, and if you look at the slashfilm.com recap of this, you can see it. Do you think that's Sarah Palmer in that image? Jonna, you can see the image, right? So what do you think?
I'll say this. I say it could be Sarah Palmer, but I'm not convinced it is Sarah Palmer, but it definitely could be Sarah Palmer. So
I think so as well. And especially because we've seen like Sarah Palmer has not been having a good time, you know, this season. And so her like involvement with the convenience store, Black Lodge, all that stuff, like it's possible like she's under their control in some way or they're in her life in a big way. So I think it's definitely possible, but I don't think it's conclusive. Moving on, in Las Vegas, Chantal assassinates Todd and his assistant.
That was a really funny scene. Sorry, it just was.
Because, well, explain why you thought it was funny.
I love Jennifer Jason Leigh in this role so much. And, you know, we get even more of it in the next episode. But like she comes and she shoots them so quickly and dispassionately. And these have been like some figures of interest, like all season long. And then they're just gone. And then she walks out, but like one's not dead. So she has to go back and she's so exasperated. And like, I don't know. She and Hutch are such efficient killers, but also just so human. They're working for this like elemental force of evil, but they're like these superhuman, you know, killing couple. I love every scene they're in. It's violent, but hilarious at the same time.
So. Interesting. You know, I find their portrayal in this series to be the only chilling characters, really, other than maybe Evil Cooper. Like, basically what I'm saying is I find it like their character is very troubling. You know?
Yeah. Well, no, I'm sorry. I'm not like they're great. They're sunshine and light. But
no,
like,
you are welcome to enjoy them as that. I'm just saying like.
No, I enjoy them. But you're right that the contrast of their like mundane preoccupations, like with snack food.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
And then just like how killing is just nothing to them.
Right. That's
fascinating to me.
That's a personal like. Thing that makes me really upset. You know what I mean? Like, we all have things that push our buttons. And for some reason, like, people who for whom death is or murder is not significant in any way, like, that's the one thing that chills me to the core. You know, I'm sure you have different things in that category, but for me, like, that's the one thing that I'm like, when I see it, it really disturbs me.
Yeah.
I rewatched six. I like over a decade ago or so, I never finished the show 6 Feet Under.
Mm-hmm.
I went back and rewatched it, finished watching season 5 recently. And there, like in the opening of every episode of 6 Feet Under, there is a character that dies, and then in earlier seasons, at least, the main characters of the show would deal with that character's funeral. And there was an episode of 6 Feet Under where a person is like tied up and he's being robbed, and then like before the robbers leave, they just like execute him with like no thought whatsoever. And you know, that scene lasted like 30 seconds, and I still think about it, like, because it's so upsetting to me personally. And I was kind of reminded of that when I saw this, where she just walks in and like kills him like she's, you know, wiping something off her feet. So I think it's very well done, but it's something that like, yeah, really, really upsets me. So in a way that like, I like it when something can upset me. Do you know what I mean? Like I enjoy work mm-hmm. that like makes me think or feel something. So
yeah.
This certainly falls into that category. But yeah, that like gurgling sound that Todd makes or his assistant makes, it's like really troubling, really troubling. Anyway.
And I was laughing. So good time. I was just laughing at her because like she's on the phone, right?
Right.
And she's just like, it's like someone trying to like, she just trying to leave work. And some one last thing just like pulls her back.
Yeah. Just got to finish up this Excel spreadsheet.
That last thing is murder.
Yeah.
It's the mundane versus the like, you know, stone cold killer that is very compelling to me.
Indeed. We go to Dougie, who reacts to hearing Gordon's name on TV and then sticks a fork into an electrical socket.
Mm-hmm.
So
he's watching Sunset Boulevard, which right. has a character like named Gordon Cole. Mm. A friend of mine, her reaction to seeing him, like he's sitting there eating cake, and her reaction to seeing him with the fork, she was like, "Baby with a fork! Like, don't leave Dougie alone with a fork near a light socket." Though it all ended very well. But I don't know. It just felt like, I guess we've been wondering all the while what it would take to wake Dougie up. Spoiler alert, this is close to it. Gordon's name is not what I expected to have trigger it, but seems to be like,
yeah, or the mechanism by which it would happen. Like I actually, you know, I thought like 10 weeks ago that it would be you know, like the coffee would wake him up, you know, that he'd become Agent Cooper with the coffee. But no, it's the sticking a fork into an electrical socket, which is kind of like he came into this world through electrical socket, right? So
yep, he sure did. Yeah, yeah.
All right. So inspired by Dr.
This is like, what does it feel too much like hitting an amnesiac with a frying pan?
A little bit.
Okay.
A little bit. Inspired by Dr. Jacoby's show, Nadine tells Ed he is free to pursue Norma. Norma lets Walter buy out the Double R franchise, then accepts Ed's marriage proposal. All right, let's talk about this. So Nadine like walks miles to tell Ed he's free, and are Norma and Walter married, or are they just like a serious couple?
I thought they were just a couple.
Yeah. Okay.
And she's just like, no, thank you.
Yeah, I mean, their relationship is so weird. It seems like very transactional and business based.
Well, my sense is this, that Norma owns this diner, and then Walter either came to her once upon a time to be like, you should franchise, or like just at least was involved in the franchising business, and like having been involved, like decided he also wanted to like court her as well. Mm. So like she allows him to like take her out to dinner and stuff like that. But like, I don't know, but like, not so serious because he doesn't live in town. Like, I think he lives elsewhere, but like, you know, serious enough that Ed was really bummed out about it. And then, you know, she's just like, you know what? We can be done here because here comes Ed.
Well, what's amazing is she doesn't even like officially break up with him, does she? Like, she just says, hey, you can have my part of the franchise.
Yeah. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And for Walter, that might as well be breaking up, it seems. Like, she doesn't even, like, officially dump him. She's just like,
yeah,
you can buy me out, and that's the end of our relationship, pretty much. So
yeah. But, like, what else does he need with her? You know what I mean? So
this is a moment that we've been waiting for decades, right?
Yeah.
Ed finally getting together with Norma. And I think one thing that this show has really shown me, Joanna Robinson, is the beauty of delayed gratification.
Yes. Right?
Like,
yes.
That if Ed had gotten together with Norma in Twin Peaks season 2, would that have been more impactful than this episode and him, like that scene with him and Norma in this episode? I don't think so.
No, and like I buy like the Lynch really sold me on like the years of waiting and loneliness in that like soup scene that I got all emotional about when we talked about last episode, where like Ed's eating soup by himself and he just seems so lonely and sad. And I'm like, I can't believe it. I can't believe Ed and Norma are not together. And also it's not just like delayed gratification, which really plays into next week's episode too, but like, or the next episode we're going to talk about, but, the mundane soap opera, like, you know, this is what Twin Peaks does so well is like, you know, sure, David Bowie's a tea kettle and there are some coordinates and like, who is Judy and what are the numbers and like, what is Sarah Palmer's face on the jumping man and all that sort of stuff. And then there's like, oh my God, Ed and Norma are together. It's so romantic. You know, like it's once again, that contrast of the mundane versus the like extraordinary. It's like, these are the different levels that Twin Peaks has always delivered on. And the soap opera has been so surprisingly compelling to me in this return. Like I care so much about Bobby and Shelley and all of that. So, I mean, particularly with the old characters, I care less about the younger generation and all of their stuff, but the song I've been loving. Oh, sorry. Did you?
No. Go ahead. Go ahead.
The Otis Redding song "I've Been Loving You Too Long" plays, and it's like such a good use of that song. So good. Even like I don't even care that it's like too on the nose, that title. Like it's so good, and it made me think of my other favorite like deeply romantic musical moment of TV this year, which was in the Leftovers finale. Also Otis Redding, "Dreams to Remember," when two people who haven't seen each other for a long time are slow dancing. So really good use of Otis Redding throughout this year in television.
Really nice, non-spoilery way to describe that scene, by the way, Joanna.
Thank you. I learned from you.
Well done. Pretty good.
Learned from you.
Pretty good.
Yeah. So,
You know what it reminded me of, actually? A scene in Synecdoche, New York. Have you seen that movie?
I haven't, no.
Oh.
It's a big hole in my pop culture knowledge.
Okay. Then I won't say exactly what happens because it's near the end of that movie and I don't want to spoil you. Not that it's really possible to spoil that movie, but I'll just say the concept of finding a lost love after many decades is something that I find really compelling. It's brought to life in that movie really well, and I thought it was done really well here. If anything, I wish there had been more time devoted to it, that relationship in this season of the show. But, you know, this season's trying to do a lot of things, and I think it does a lot of them well. But, yeah, it leaves me wanting more, and I think that's actually sometimes a good thing. So, all right, what else happens this episode? Gersten attempts to console an armed suicidal Steve.
I hated all of this.
In the woods. I can't even finish the sentence. Hiding from a passerby, she hears a gunshot. This is like a massive, like lengthy scene.
It's so long. Yeah. I hate everything with Steven, even though I like Caleb Landry Jones usually. I hate everything with Steven this season. It's not working for me.
Why isn't it working? Because there's okay, go ahead. Finish what you're saying and then I'll try to convince you.
It's like so over the top. The rhythm of it is just so frenetic. And that's been true for like almost all of his scenes. Mm-hmm. And I just I hate the kid, obviously. I was like, do it. Kill yourself. No one stop him. I hate this guy. He beats his wife.
I guess the show has done a poor job of making him be like a sympathetic character in any way, right?
Yeah.
Like the best, you know, drug addict wife beaters on TV are the ones that you can kind of in some ways like root for. Like you have some like they're anti-heroes that are terrible people, but that like you see enough in them that you want them to succeed or get better in some way. And this was not a well-rounded portrait of a character like mm-hmm. that, I think.
Yeah.
So kind of a bummer, but I mean there as with almost everything in this show, there was an audacity to the length of the scene and the pacing of the scene, how excruciatingly slow it was, that, you know, I thought was at least worth considering.
I will say that I don't like it, but I have learned by now that I should just like trust that whatever Lynch is going to do, I'm here for it. You know what I mean? Like, I don't like it, but I trust that the rhythm of it somehow probably enhanced my enjoyment of like the slower Ed stuff elsewhere or something, you know?
Right.
Something
there's like some, that. There's some method
that we
madness.
Needed this bitters in this particular cocktail in this episode. Mm. But if I never have to watch that scene again, I'll be happy. So, yeah.
The log lady calls Hawk and gives him a final message before dying.
Oh my God.
Yeah, so this is the end of the log lady. She passes away in the show, and we know that the actress passed away in real life as well. Very poignant moment. Very poignant moment.
I mean, and she even says, like, she filmed her scenes and she looked so sick because she, of course, she was sick, and we knew that. But like, I didn't know like how sort of self aware they were going to make this, you know what I mean? Like they meant to portray her as sick. We know the actress passed away, but for her to actually say, "I'm dying, Hawk," which she did in this episode, was just very powerful. And this, I mean, this show is just really messing me up when it comes to like almost incidentally messing me up when it comes to like mortality because of the David Bowie, Miguel Ferrer, Catherine, it's Coulson, is it Coulson? Of it all. Like, Catherine Coulson. It's just the way in which they're dealing with all the, I mean, the Albert stuff is not, he's just there and he's just great and you know he's gone. It was very powerful. Really, really good.
Yeah. Sometimes I think I was listening to the commentary, the P.T. Anderson's commentary of Magnolia. Mm. And he's talking about how, I think it was him. I'm not 100% sure if this is right, but I think it was him talking about how he felt really uncomfortable with Jason Robards playing the role of the dying father because it's like, this guy is actually getting pretty close to the age where he might actually be going through this, and that there's this kind of like tension and discomfort with showing an old person dying on screen, like the character dying. But the way it was done in the show was really beautiful. You know, it really got to me. It's a beautiful moment, and she's obviously been kind of like advising and intoning these like spiritual truths this whole season, and for her to go out like this and for everyone to kind of give her a moment, I thought it was very lovely. So nicely done in the show.
Yeah, right. She says,
yep, go ahead.
Her dying speech, right, is like, "Hawk, I'm dying. You know about death, that it's just a change, not an end. Hawk, it's time. There's some fear in letting go. Remember what I told you. I can't say more over the phone, but you know what I mean. From our talks, when we were able to speak face to face, watch for that one, the one I told you about. The one under the moon on Blue Pine Mountain. Hawk, my log is turning gold. The wind is moaning. I'm dying. Good night, Hawk." Like, God.
Yeah.
God. Oh, yeah. This show. Man, yeah. So good.
Yeah. It's good stuff. Really, really just well done. So moving on, in the Wikipedia summary here, Audrey and Charlie continue arguing. That's all that happens here.
I will say this. I mean, I can talk about what happens in the next week's episode, right?
Yeah, of course.
This episode is where like a friend told me, he's like, "Oh, Audrey's obviously either in a coma or in a lodge or like something, like she's not in the reality." And I was like, yeah, that makes a lot of sense to me. And like, then that takes some of the pain away from these Audrey scenes to right. Like, as far as I'm concerned, we'll talk about that more later. But like, this is the episode where I was like, yeah, yeah, that makes sense.
Josh from DC emailed us at peakstv@gmail.com. He writes in, "Just encountered this theory and thought it was really intriguing. Is it possible Audrey's still in a coma and her scenes take place in a coma dream? Keep in mind Monica Bellucci's line from Cole's dream, 'We are like the dreamer who dreams and then lives inside the dream. But who is the dreamer? Is Audrey living inside her dream? Might her eventual awakening or return be linked to Dougie/Coops? Good questions. Good questions. And we'll talk more about that in a little bit. But let's say she is in a mental dream state somehow. Like, does that mean retroactively you're cool with all the Audrey scenes?
I'm less upset about it. Yeah.
Right. Well, because then it's like the frustration that you're experiencing with how opaque and ridiculous these scenes are, it kind of mirrors her feeling of trappedness in whatever place, right. whatever hell she's in. Right.
Her frustration and her inability to leave that room. And my frustration over it had a purpose. And I should have, like, really, these last two episodes, you said delayed gratification, that's part of it. But just these last two episodes really just proved to me that, like, oh my God, just trust David Lynch. Just trust him. And anyway, this is part of that for sure.
Indeed. All right. What else happens in this episode? At the Roadhouse, James is attacked by Renee's jealous husband, Chuck, whom Freddie punches out with his glove. Freddie and James are arrested. A young woman crawls across the floor of the Roadhouse floor and screams. I think that's Charlene Yee, right? That crawls across the floor.
Yeah, it is Charlene Yee.
Yeah.
Brian Davis in the chat room says when he joined the chat tonight, he said, have they talked about the better Iron Fist yet? And I didn't know who he was talking about at first. And I was like, oh, he means Hulk Hand, which is what I've been calling him. But, better Iron Fist also works for me. So, yeah, this powerful gloved hand, which we're expecting might be used on Evil Cooper, but like maybe we should learn not to expect anything. But
well,
yeah.
I think the fact that you see a demonstration now, like you've now witnessed the power of this fully operational Hulk hand,
mm-hmm.
Means that it's distinctly possible we'll see it again. It's a Chekhov's Hulk hand, I think.
Yeah. Chekhov's rubber fist, says yeah. Dylan Schwan in the chat room. Yeah. So. Yeah.
So it's possible we will see it take out Cooper, especially since we've seen its power now. Interesting set of scenes at the Roadhouse. The Charlene Yee thing, definitely troubling scene.
Mm-hmm.
So there was a little bit more conversation about like what these Roadhouse scenes mean, right? You talked last week about how someone broke it down, and you tweeted out this diagram that someone made. It was pretty impressive. Yeah. About like all the Roadhouse scenes. Like,
yeah.
what do you think now? Like, we get a Roadhouse scene this week, next week. Like, we're basically at the end here. We're two episodes away from the end. Do you have any conclusion about what these scenes mean at this point? Like, how do you choose to interpret them?
Well, it's weird because the Audrey one is fantasy. But the Roadhouse is definitely reality because it interacts with characters that we've seen in the reality, provided as long as anything's reality in the show. And I have to hope that some of it is. But, you know, we've seen like Shelley in there and Red and stuff like that. So, like, you know, we feel like it also exists in reality. But it just seems like they got all these, you know, like I don't expect we'll ever see Jane Levy again. Like Jane Levy got hired to do like one Roadhouse scene, it seems. You know, obviously we saw Richard Horne in there. So I don't have a good answer.
Yeah.
No.
I mean, I don't blame you for it.
Yeah.
But I did think the way this Charlene Yee scene played out with her screaming. I mean, David Lynch knows how to create disturbing imagery. And I feel like that image of her crawling across the ground and screaming, it's deeply troubling. James is attacked by Renee's jealous husband. Anything we have to say about that? Like, I feel like the James-Renee relationship is pretty we don't have that much to go on, you know? Like, we had
that song.
You had the song from last week, right?
Yeah.
But that's basically
I don't know if it's, like, all just there to give us a demonstration of the
Hulk hand?
Of the Hulk hand.
It's all, you know? It's all just – he's all just pulling the strings for the Hulk hand. so, anyway – Freddie and James are arrested. They're put in that jail cell with Nido is there. The guy with the stuff coming out of his mouth is there.
Uh-huh.
Anything else we have to say about this episode? I thought this was overall episode 15 was a solid episode, right? Like, gave us a lot of like the Ed and Norma stuff, like really disturbing stuff with Evil Cooper, and Log Lady passing away, getting her goodbye. Checks a lot of boxes of what I want to see from a Twin Peaks episode. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Other than the stuff with Stephen in the woods, which like, I'll take, that's fine. This is a great episode. So yeah.
But it was just an amuse-bouche, just a little appetizer for part 16 of the show, which, oh my God, let's get into it. Evil Cooper and Richard follow a set of coordinates. Jerry Horn, like, it's all coming together, Joanna. Jerry Horn has been wandering around in the forest. He arrives upon the scene, and he sees what's going on. Evil Cooper sends Richard ahead to this site where he is electrocuted. So let's pause here for a moment. Like, what is exactly going on here? These coordinates are given to Evil Cooper as a way of destroying him, sending him back to the Black Lodge, killing him, right? But he sends Richard in his place. That's my interpretation.
So, like, Jeffrey is, you know, is sort of like acting as we discussed in I think the last podcast episode. There's precedence early in the season for like to suspect that Jeffrey's like wants Evil Cooper gone because he wants like all of the evil Bob spirit for himself. So the coordinates were like sort of, I don't know, a trap or something like that. And so Evil Cooper's like, well, let's just see what happens when this kid goes there. And, you know, what happens is that he gets completely fried. And more intriguingly, right, is that Evil Cooper
reveals, right, that
calls him son.
Now, maybe he was just using that as like a saying. But more likely, he was saying Richard was actually his son.
Yeah.
So the casualness with which he does that is very troubling, obviously. But also, it implies that the theory that you've put forward on this show, that he raped Audrey, is likely accurate, right?
Yeah.
So, yeah.
And not the only rape revelation of the episode.
Indeed. Anyway, Chantal and Hutch are killed by a neighbor they provoke outside the Jones residence. I thought this scene was actually hilarious.
Okay, so you see what I'm saying, right? The Chantal stuff.
Well, it's hilarious when they're not killing people, you know. Like, it's hilarious
when they're being killed.
I mean, I think the best part was when like those Mitchum brothers are there, and like one of them says like, "What kind of neighborhood is this?" And he says like, "People are under a lot of stress here." That is an amazing line.
They have their gun ready, but then they're like, but then, you know, like the FBI comes and makes the neighbor put his gun down, and like, they're like, oh, okay, he put the gun. Okay, we can put our gun away. He put the gun. Like, I love the Mitchum brothers so much. Like, who knew that Jim Belushi would like be such a bright spot? But I loved it. Like, all the various pieces at work in this cul-de-sac shootout around the Jones household really tickled me.
So, yeah, no. And it kind of goes towards the whole this whole idea of Dougie, like this maelstrom unfolding around Dougie that he's like seemingly unaware of. In this case, Dougie's house, right? Like, all this stuff's going down around his house. Like, people are dying, people are trying to kill him, and he's just blissfully unaware.
Yeah.
Until this episode, when Dougie awakes from the coma. And we realize that he has become Cooper again. Now, Joanna, you have said in the past episodes of this podcast that you didn't think we'd ever see Cooper again, right?
I was worried we would never see Cooper again, yes.
So how delighted were you when this happened?
I was delighted, but you know what was hilarious? You know what, like, what magic Lynch worked here? I was delighted and then immediately sad for the loss of Dougie Jones. I was like, yay, it's Cooper. Oh, Dougie. And then, Cooper does this like white knighting thing where like one of the first things he does is like insist that Mike make another Dougie Jones, basically. Right. He's like, you still have the seed, pulls one of his hairs, which I guess like, you know, and so like we find out that Dougie was made by, I thought Dougie was made by Evil Cooper, but it seems like he was made by Mike and Dale. For some reason, I don't know. Maybe I'm wrong about that, but you know, he's basically like, make another one, you know, because basically I'm going to be leaving this family and I care about this family. And so at least give them a replacement for me. But I was just immediately sad. I was sad for Janie E and I was sad for Sonny Jim and, you know, and all of that. But that's all wrapped up in the excitement of seeing Kyle MacLachlan say, I am the FBI. And then, like, I swear to you, Dave Chen, and I think I don't usually do this. Well, I was just talking about it with the log lady, but, like, I I cried. I cried when the music just really boomed, you know, and I just like the music swelled, the old score, and it really got me. So that was my roller coaster of emotions. How about you?
Yeah. So I'll say a couple things about that scene. I don't know that I cried, but I did get very emotional because obviously Dale Cooper is like this wonderful, you know, humanistic character that's very beloved, and to see him return, it's just like a very wonderful moment. But also, I was so impressed with Kyle MacLachlan in that moment, because you realize how different Dale Cooper is as a character than any of the other characters he's played in the show so far, right? Mm-hmm. This season, Dougie and Evil Cooper are just so radically different than Dale Cooper, and you totally buy the transfer. There's not one moment of doubt I had about like that this is a completely different person. You know, I wasn't like, oh, that's an actor who's portrayed one character, now he's portraying another. It's like, oh no, this is a person that made a transformation. Mm-hmm. And that's a subtle difference, but it is there. And I thought he did an amazing, amazing job.
Yeah.
Second thing I want to point out is you talk about the soundtrack. It's easy to forget how occasionally overbearing that soundtrack was in the original series.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, he just hit those same themes over and over and over and over and over again in those episodes. And used like the same B-roll over and over again in those episodes. And I did, you know, start to really tire of it by the end. And he basically has almost never used it this season, right? Like, I don't even recall hearing it once until this episode, other than the opening credits, of course. And so to hear that theme come back while they're cruising down the street, it just made me feel like this is Twin Peaks again. This is like the Twin Peaks that we know. Everything's converging back on Twin Peaks in you know, Washington. And Dale Cooper's back. And and so I thought, we were talking about delayed gratification. I mean, it's incredible. It just is like, it's a study. You know, we obviously have another recap podcast about Game of Thrones, and everything's happening so quickly there. And this is this season, but like, this is a study in how you draw out something that's really anticipated for an incredibly long time. Now, of course, Game of Thrones has been airing for like 7 seasons, so one could argue that many of the things that happened this episode people have been waiting for many years. But I don't know. It just felt very satisfying the way it happened this episode with the return
of
Dale
Cooper. I feel like we've been cracking all these cynical jokes of like, you know, talking about the when and like, oh, he's going to make his way, blah, blah, blah. But like, I mean, maybe it would have been as good earlier or as good later, but this felt like the right time. And then we're heading into this two-part finale next week, which is essentially going to be like another Twin Peaks movie, right? Another 2 hours of Twin Peaks. And it's just like, okay, our hero is here and he's saddling up and he's riding into battle for our movie. And which is like, you brought up Game of Thrones, like that's sort of like exactly the kind of thing that you would say about an episode of Game of Thrones. But this just feels like so much more true to like a white knight hero narrative than, you know, than anything we've seen on that show in a little while. So, I'm so pleased by this episode.
You know, one thing that we kind of blew past is we haven't, these Wikipedia summaries haven't mentioned the abusive local FBI relationship. You know what I'm talking about?
Are you talking about Stan from Mad Men?
I think that's correct. Yeah, like there's those two FBI agents, like one of whom is very abusive to him.
Yeah.
Kind of curious, like it feels
you watched Mad Men, right?
I did. I don't remember that specific character, but
okay.
But it feels like a lot of law enforcement is portrayed like very like quirky, weird ways. Like it's something that Lynch has done in Twin Peaks historically. And I don't know if you had any opinion on like what the effect of that character was.
That's so interesting, because I think that, you know, because I have such fond associations with that actor, J.R. Ferguson, who played Stan Rizzo on Mad Men, and, you know, has been, was part of, Leonardo DiCaprio's Pussy Posse has like been around for a long time. He's such like a kind of a lovable actor that like I find his yelling to be hilarious. I feel like once this feels like Chantal Redux, like something that you find disturbing, I find hilarious.
Oh, I didn't find it disturbing. And actually, by the way, I just realized who that character is. I didn't recognize him because he looks a lot different in this show.
Yeah.
He lost the beard. Yeah.
Yeah. Beard's gone. Yeah. I don't know. I find it funny. But I think if you're looking for like a referendum on law enforcement, you certainly want to look at like the detectives Fusco as like this corrupt, terrible sort of like bumbling situation. But then of course it's like Twin Peaks would never be like a wholly negative exploration of law enforcement because the sheriff's department in Twin Peaks is such like a bastion of virtue and heroes, even though there's like terrible characters in there like Chad. So, yeah, I don't know. I mean, do you feel like he's trying to say something specific here?
No, I mean, not that I can tell. I mean, it felt just like very, it felt quirky. It didn't feel like, it's obviously an abusive relationship, but it didn't feel like he's trying to disturb you with it. It felt like he's trying to show you that this is just a weird, weird, quirky relationship. That was my interpretation. Anyway, so moving on, Diane receives a text from the doppelganger and then tells the task force that the last time she saw Cooper, he raped her and took her to an old gas station, exclaiming, I'm in the sheriff's station. I'm not me. She pulls a gun and is shot by Albert and Tammy, then drawn to the Red Room where she dissolves into a seed. So let's talk about this scene. Like, I think the Diane stuff so far this season has been, for me, a mixed bag. Mm-hmm. She started out really strong, very, very like striking look, very memorable character, but there hasn't really been anything to that character beyond like some of her quirks and her pugnaciousness, you know, like her profanity, that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
But this episode really was an excellent showcase of Laura Dern's capabilities as an actress, I thought.
Yeah.
When she's describing the scene and horrified at the things that have happened to her, I thought it's incredible. It also implies that who we're seeing is either not Diane or like a version of Diane that has been corrupted in some way, right?
Well, I think it's sort of like Dougie. She's a tulpa, which is like this sort of doppelganger spirit sort of thing. She goes back into the lodge and then she dissolves and there's a whole seed. Like, so it's the same thing that happened with Dougie. So she was put out in the world, as, I don't know, a decoy, but, obviously has some of Diane's like actual memories. Cause the performance was like very much about Diane.
So there is a real Diane, but like who we saw was not her. Like the Diane that Cooper left the messages for in the tape, like that was not her. Laura Dern is not her. Is that right?
Right. She says, I'm at the sheriff's station. Or department. And most people think that she's probably like the real Diane is actually that like Nido figure that's unable to talk, that's in the sheriff's department. So whether or not that, you know, if and when they figure out who that person is, she will actually look like Laura Dern, or if she will look like the Asian actress who's playing her. Like some people are like, oh, is that why Laura Dern's character was sort of dressed in like a sort of like Asian style all season? I don't know about that. But and then there's also this theory that Nido is also the Judy that Jeffries is talking about. So like she's Diane and Judy and Nido. And like it's a lot for one person. But then again, we only have 2 hours left. So, you know, got to condense our female characters somehow. But yeah, so this is like sort of a doppelganger version of Diane. But like I do believe that that the real Diane was raped by Evil Cooper.
So the real Diane might be Naito, but if not that, then where would she be, do you think?
In the lodge somewhere?
Yeah. Well, we don't see her, right?
But she says she's at the sheriff's department, so like I can't think of any anywhere else she would be. Mm. You know?
Gotcha. So so presumably all forces, all characters are converging in Twin Peaks for next week, right? And we might find out what happens at the sheriff's station with Diane.
I mean, unless Diane is actually Chad. I'm just kidding. Right. I don't think so.
I don't think that's right, yeah. That's one theory I don't buy, Jonah. Okay. At the Roadhouse, Audrey dances alone to Audrey's Dance, the song. When a fight breaks out, Audrey begs Charlie to take her home. Suddenly, she appears elsewhere, looking at her reflection in a mirror. When I read those words, when I think about that that scene, I get chills. I get chills. Because it is so disturbing. Like the whole thing, the way it played out, was so disturbing because it's at the Roadhouse. So there's been weird stuff happening at the Roadhouse, like with the Charlene Yee stuff and the Hulk fist and stuff. But for the most part, it feels set in reality, right? It feels like something that takes place in the real world. And so when Audrey starts dancing and like everyone starts like swaying along with her in this kind of weird way, it feels like, oh, like the reality of this Roadhouse has been broken, which intensifies more when she like, you know, asks Charlie to take her home, and then like you flash to this crazy white room where Audrey is freaking out. It really upset me. What did you think of this scene, Jonah?
At what point did you feel like this wasn't reality that we were looking at?
I think that because the Roadhouse stuff has been so weird, I wasn't necessarily thinking, oh, well, because Audrey's dancing, like, it's not real. Like, I didn't think that because we've seen so much weird stuff. But then, of course, when it like when she appears elsewhere looking at a reflection, that seems pretty strongly to imply that Audrey is stuck in some kind of coma or some kind of, mental prison of some kind.
Since I had this theory floating around in my head, when they were like, now Audrey's dance, I was like, oh, this isn't real. Like, this is definitely not, because like when she showed up the Roadhouse, I was like, oh, maybe she is in the real world. Like, she got out of that room, so maybe she's not like trapped in something. And then she like does her dance. So, but like, you know, it just seemed to like, this is your life sort of like, it's all about Audrey. And I'm like, oh, this is not real. And then I was curious to see like where they would go from there. And then the smash cut to what kind of looks like a mental – it only looks like a mental hospital because of, like, what she's wearing. But she's also –
it's also
like,
white everywhere, right?
It's white, but she's, like, staring into, like, a magnified makeup mirror. It's a very weird mirror to have in a mental hospital. But, like, perhaps she does. And, you know, she has no makeup on and she's just screaming. And it is very disturbing and very good. So –
yeah.
So, and so we're really seeing like, you know, this is something that I felt like was true early in the season, that like Evil Cooper came out of the lodge and raped and like shattered the lives of the two women who are most important to the real Cooper, or to Audrey and Diane. I guess we won't talk about Heather Graham's character, but so to see the ramification of that on both of them in this episode, they're just so disturbed by what happened to them is really powerful. And like, you know, Lynch has gotten criticized for his portrayal of women in general, and you know, specifically in this season, like that sexy woman who was like taking forever to say goodbye to Gordon at one point, or I had a problem with Candy, right, who hangs around the Mission Brothers, like stuff like that. But like the heartbreak of Janie E, which is like a much like a slightly more innocuous one, but not that innocuous, you know, because she like loved this version of Dougie, and then he's just going to leave and she's never, probably never going to see him again. Right. And then,
well, she's never going to see Dale Cooper again, but like you said, maybe they'll create a Dougie version of...
Well, I hope they get a better Dougie for her, because like the original Dougie sucked, right?
Yep.
He like had terrible hair and cheated on her. It's bad news. Yep. So there's that, and then the Diane and Audrey stuff. Like, this is a really, good and interesting episode for women, and not just as victims, but because I know that's another accusation that's levied at Lynch, is that, like, he just makes his women victims. But the thing that, when we talked about Firewalk with Me, the thing that I really appreciated is that it took Laura Palmer from, like, silent victim wrapped in plastic to, like, a real human. And you got to see her the whole side of her story. And I think that's what, hopefully we'll see more of this with Audrey, but certainly what we got from Diane, or this version of Diane, is just a really a mature and I think sensitive depiction of abuse. So it was very, very good, I thought.
Let's talk also about the Janie E. goodbye scene, right? So a couple of things I wanted to mention about that. First of all, I loved that Dale Cooper, like, calls up the Mitchum brothers and, like, hey, I need a plane to Spokane. And then you see them go, like, well, I guess we're going to Spokane. Like, what are these guys doing all day? What are they just following Dougie around at this point? Anyway, I thought it was funny that, like, Dougie's determining their personal itinerary right now.
Yeah.
And then says goodbye to Janie. Now, we haven't mentioned the fact that, like, Dale Cooper apparently is himself, but retains all the memories of Dougie, right?
Yeah.
So I just thought that was interesting that he knows he is aware of what has happened, but he hasn't, like, commented on it really. He mentions it to the Mitchum brothers and that he's part of the FBI. But anyway, I just thought that was an interesting way of portraying that character, because we're usually used to seeing someone snap out of it and they have no memory of what happened before, right?
Yeah, yeah.
Some kind of amnesiac spell or something like that. But yeah,
John Chilton in the chat room says the new Dougie will be cool because good Coop made him. And John said earlier in the chat that he believes that evil Coop did make Dougie. I mean, that makes most sense to me that evil Coop made Dougie Jones. But, like, hopefully, I wish good Coop had given Mike some instructions. You need to make another one. Make it better this time. Make it a nice one. That's what she deserves. Something like that. But it is interesting. I love when he was, like, talking to Dougie's boss, and, like, just all, like, everything about all of his interactions with these characters that we've only seen Dougie talk to is just really, really charming.
I love that people sense barely any difference between Dale Cooper and Dougie. like, they're like, oh, yeah, he's talking a little bit different, but, like, no one's like, this is a completely different person now,
Right.
I thought that was kind of amusing. So, John Robinson, this is, like, probably our favorite episode of the show so far. I mean, you got two really disturbing scenes. You got the scene with, like, at the end with Audrey, and you got the Diane scene. You got Chantel and Hutch getting assassinated in a fairly hilarious fashion. Mm-hmm. You got Dale Cooper returning. I mean, this is just, like, everything we've always wanted in Twin Peaks, or at least that I've always wanted, or a lot of things that I've wanted in Twin Peaks is coming to a head in this episode. So this is an awesome episode, but it seems pretty clear to me that there's absolutely no way they can resolve all the plot lines in the next two episodes, right? Like,
well, define all the plot lines.
Okay, let's define the plot lines. I mean, Evil Cooper and Dale Cooper, like, they probably need to hash things out, right?
Sure.
What's going on with Amanda Seyfried's character?
Becky.
Becky and what's her name? Gersten. Are we ever going to?
So you're saying you're, like, dying for more Steven scenes?
That's exactly what I'm saying. Well, I'm just talking about what the unresolved plot lines are.
Sure. Shelley and Bobby, Red.
Are we going to learn more about, like, the glass box thing at the beginning? Are we going to learn any more about Jeffries?
I feel like we will. I think a lot of that stuff, I could become totally wrong, but, like, the glass box stuff, the Jeffries stuff, I think all of that stuff is going to be, like, reasonably wrapped up. I think some of the Twin Peaks soap opera might be left dangling, but, like, we've got a lot of satisfaction there. Like, I mean, Bobby, I don't know what's going to happen with Bobby and Shelley, but, like, the evolution of Bobby feels very satisfying to me. The Ed stuff feels very satisfying to me. Richard Horton is dead, thank God. I hate that kid. I don't know about like the other Horns. You're right. I mean,
right. Ashley Judd's character. They like, won't, is anything like, gonna?
Yeah, I feel like nothing's ever gonna come of that. I could be wrong.
Yeah, Jerry Horn, Ben Horn.
Remember like how Ashley we met? Remember how we met Ashley Judd's husband, her invalid husband.
Like, what was up with that? Yeah. You know, like, is it? Are but we gonna like, find out what happens
you,
to that?
But are you really? Are you gonna be mad if like some of that stuff doesn't get?
I'm not gonna be mad. I'm just, but I'm just making the statement that like we're not. I have a feeling there's gonna be a lot of those things we never follow up on any of them. So, that's okay, I think. I think that's okay. We have to – we're already willing to accept a lot. And here's the thing, Joanna. Let me put this out there too. This whole thing has been way more narratively coherent than I thought it would be, right? Oh, yeah. Like overall, it's a lot more comprehensive. There's a lot of stuff I still don't get, but it is a lot more comprehensible than I would have guessed going into this season. So, I mean, is there anything you're really looking forward to seeing in the finale?
I want to find out, A, what's happening with Diane. B, okay, so when the, like, what's weird is, like, when the Tulpa left, like, they shot the Tulpa that was Diane, and she left, and she went into the lodge, and then she just, like, fell apart. I could have sworn to you that, like, the way the editing worked, it kind of looked to me like she went into Albert, though I just don't think that makes any sense. But he, like... Maybe it was meant to show that, like, she passed through him or something like that.
Yeah, but, I don't think she went into him. That was not my interpretation.
I don't think so either, but, like, it just – I just want to register that in case I'm right or in case that's right.
I don't know if that's – I don't know if that's quite how predictions work. but
let me register all possibilities.
Yeah,
and then say I was right about this.
Imagine all possibilities.
Like,
that's right.
There's just, like, a weird thing that happens with Miguel Ferrer's, like, I don't know. I was like freaked out for a second, and then she was in the lodge and I was like, okay, maybe not. I don't expect that everything's going to get wrapped up. I don't really care if it does, but yeah, Diane stuff. I'm interested in. Like Diane, Audrey and Dale stuff. I'm really, really interested in.
Yeah. Yeah. Me too.
Like those three things are very interesting to me.
I want to see Evil Cooper vanquished from the world because he's inflicted lots of pain and suffering on people. Mm-hmm. So
yeah.
But yeah, that's – and I kind of want to know what the heck's going on with Audrey, right? So
yeah.
So that's what I'm looking forward to on the finale. And it's going to be a two-hour finale next week, right?
Mm-hmm.
Over Labor Day weekend. So looking forward to talking about that with you guys. And our episode recapping the finale will be out like that week, probably on Thursday or Friday of that week, like a few days after the finale airs. You'll be able to hear us talk about it. Also, before we wrap up – I think there's a few names we didn't thank this year from the Kickstarter. And so I want to thank Devin Beirut, Evan Krieger, and Danny Nacken. Thanks so much for your donations to our Kickstarter that made this podcast possible.
We hope you've
enjoyed listening to our somewhat leisurely stroll through the world of Twin Peaks. It's certainly a show that I've at this point, certainly after watching episode 16, I'm just really grateful we're talking about it. Mm-hmm. It's not a show I would have ever watched if you didn't propose this idea, Jonah Robinson. So I'm grateful that we're watching it because, man, that like episode 16, some of the best moments on television I'll see this year, I think. So,
yeah, I'm so happy we did this. I feel like if we had, I want to say actually a couple more things before we go. Like,
yep.
I feel like if we hadn't done this experiment, like one of the reasons why I wanted to do this is because I knew doing this podcast regularly with you would have kept me up on top of Twin Peaks in a way that I might have been tempted to fall behind because things get so crazy with Game of Thrones for us. But, I kept on top of it. Doing it every other week was great. And that means that miraculously the return of Dale – I didn't watch Twin Peaks on Sunday night this week because it was the Game of Thrones finale. But I watched it Monday afternoon. Miraculously, the return of Dale Cooper was not spoiled for me. I can't believe that happened. And so then I got to experience it in like sort of real time and just like have it happen. And I was thinking about it. Like I was so emotional about it. And I was thinking about it. I was like, this is never going to happen for anyone else watching the show again. Because if you watch Twin Peaks after this, you're likely not going to watch it on a week to week basis, right? That's not how people watch like old TV shows anymore, right? They binge. So you're not going to have had, what is it, 13 weeks or fewer? I don't know. 13 weeks of waiting for Dale Cooper and then like have that gratification and not knowing when he's going to come and be surprised by him coming. And that's something we all got to experience together. Even though I did it a day late, like watching it all together on Sunday nights without anyone knowing what's going to happen has been a really amazing experience. And because Game of Thrones is over and because I have next Sunday off, I get to watch Twin Peaks finale with friends like a normal human would, like in a room with other people, which I never get to do. And I'm so excited for like the 2-hour finale of Twin Peaks, and maybe even more excited than that other, you know, big show that we podcast about, just because it just, the experience feels so, sounds so stupid to say, but it feels so pure to me.
Yeah.
And I just really admire what Lynch has put together.
So. I know what you're saying. I think I actually think the show would be better enjoyed binged, but I agree that on a week-to-week basis, there is some kind of like event-ish feel to it, you know, that you're watching something that nothing like it has ever been put to television before, and likely nothing ever will again. So that's our thoughts on these last two episodes. Next week, we'll be back with season finale thoughts. John Robinson, in the meantime, where can you find more of your work on the internet?
You can find me on VanityFair.com. You can follow me on Twitter at Joe Wrote This. You can hear us talking about Game of Thrones on Cast of Kings, or me talking about Game of Thrones on Storm of Spoilers, or me talking about Toronto Film Festival and the Telluride Film Festival over on Little Gold Men.
Find all my stuff at DaveChen.net. Thanks so much for listening. We'll see you next week.